Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Menard against the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Mr. Dolman.
Good morning, Your Honors. Robert Dolman for the appellant. To succeed in this appeal, we have to prevail on two issues, one the reasonable amount test and one the disguised dividend test. We believe that we satisfy both prongs. We believe that Exacto is controlling. We believe that the tax court either misapplied or ignored the binding precedent, that being the Seventh Circuit case of Menards. Again, there are two tests. Permit me to address the first test, and then I'll go on, subject to time and questions, on the second test. First test, we denominated as the reasonable amount test. Teaching of Exacto is that the reasonable amount test is satisfied in the following situation. If an independent investor is more than satisfied with his or her rate of return, then there's a presumption that the reasonable test is satisfied. I note that the IRS in the lower court conceded that the independent investor test was satisfied. I note that the IRS conceded that the rebuttable presumption test was satisfied. Let's talk about the rebuttable presumption. Again, if the rate of return is sufficiently high such that an independent investor would be more than pleased, then there's a presumption that the reasonable amount test is satisfied. This presumption is rebuttable.
How would it be rebutted?
It's only rebutted based on addressing the efforts of the executive who's received the payment.
The effort? What do you mean?
I beg your pardon?
The effort?
Yes.
Whether he goes to the office at 9 or something, or what?
Good. No. In other words, if the executive had a significant contribution and did have a significant contribution to the performance, the financial performance of the company. For example, if the executive was a mere titular executive, or if the executive's efforts had a minimal impact on the performance of the company. For example, there was some extraneous event that triggered the high rate of return.
Right, like the oil company.
Like the oil. Well,
but here's where I see a problem with your case, and it's a distinction between this case and Exacto. In Exacto, although the CEO owned 55% of the company or so, there were other shareholders. And, they had large interests, and they weren't family or anything like that. And they had approved this. In this case, however, the board is a complete captive. It has no significance, really. And I take it that the board, now, as I understand from your brief, your accountant suggested an incentive program for Menard, but I don't think you hired a compensation consultant the board didn't hire a compensation consultant who might have provided some, ex ante indication that this was a reasonable scheme.
Your Honor, some history. Just from my point of view, this discussion would go more towards the reasonable amount test and your hypothetical would go more towards the disguised dividend test, in other words, other shareholders approving.
No, not really. I'm thinking of an analogy in contract law to the distinction between a procedural and substantive unconscionability. So you could have a contract where the print is too fine to read, or the buyer doesn't know English or has some mental impairment. But then also you can look at the terms of the contract and say they're so one-sided, the buyer must not have understood what was going on. So likewise, on the substantive side, I don't think the $20 million is necessarily outrageous or anything of that sort. But on the procedural side, what is the procedure established that would give us some confidence that this was not just a tax dodge?
A couple points or more. Number one, this concept of a percentage was not originated with John Menard. If you look at the initial minutes and when this was approved and then the minutes right before that, all of which is in the record, It is clear that executives
of the... I understand, but the choice of the percentage is great. And also, is this, was this intended to be 5% a year in and year out, or was this going to be reexamined every year, every 2 years, or something of that sort? Or do we know? Is it in the record?
The record doesn't state that, but what the record does state is that it was renewed every year before the beginning of the year in issue.
Before. So
right.
When had it started?
More than 20 years ago. It's in the record. 5%. That 5% was religiously applied. There was no manipulation.
No, I'm just curious.
So this
had been going on for 20 years, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And again, it was religiously applied. There was really no manipulation. So if the net income of the company went up, the bonus went up. If the net income went down, as the record shows...
I'm puzzled by the concept of a religiously applied salary. Did the members of the board genuflect to Mr. Menard when he came into the room?
Let me say that I would say a synonym to religiously applied would be consistently applied.
Okay.
Thank you.
If that 5% bonus was meant to compensate him for his services, why would he agree to return any portion the IRS disallowed as a deduction? If he really earned that money by performing services, wouldn't he be entitled to keep it regardless of Menard's ability to deduct it?
One other point on that point, let me just say that this program was started when there was an independent third-party shareholder, namely Jeff Smith, which is also in the record. But to your point, Your Honor, this was a business decision made at that time, which was renewed every year, and it was just not for compensation. It was commissions. It was rent to the extent John Menard leased property to the company. It was interest to the extent John Menard loan money to the company. So it was across the board with respect to any payments to the company. This reimbursement program was designed to make the company whole. And obviously, if the company deducted it, the company saved taxes. If the company deducted it but could not deduct it, the tax savings was less. So the agreement was, for good business reasons, to make the company whole. Namely, to have to repay the agreement, to repay the sum. The amount was disallowed.
Are there other years that the IRS is challenging, or just?
Yes, this was the
later
first
years or earlier years.
Later years, more recent years. Uh-huh. The IRS looked at this issue. We're talking about the 12 months ending January of 1998. Prior to that, the IRS had looked at it. There was no issue raised. The subsequent years. The issue has been raised, and it's before the U.S. Tax Court. But if I may continue.
Let me just ask one other question about this 5%. How is the 5% bonus different from a dividend?
There were no declared dividends because the company felt that it wanted to reinvest all it could, and the fact was that it was determined that the shareholders were pleased with the return on investment, namely the huge amount of increase in the value of the stock. For example, just in our year, Your Honor, the taxable income, namely all profits less deductions, the deduction including salary, compensation, bonus, was $315 million. From when this program was started more than 20 years until through the end of our taxable year, there was something like a 300-fold increase in the retained earnings of the company. So, if I may continue, the per exacto, and strictly as to the reasonable amount test, once the rebuttable presumption is triggered, as the tax court found it was, as the IRS conceded, then the presumption is only rebutted by addressing the performance or lack of performance of the executive.
So is it your position that so long as the company provides returns that are slightly above the industry benchmark that the company can deduct $1 billion from its taxes as executive compensation if that turns out to be the number from the formula?
Your Honor, respectfully, I do not know. I'm guided by what Exacto says specifically, and then if there's any commentary by other court of appeals as to what Exacto says. Exacto really was a narrow situation. It was a situation where the executive, received bonuses. It was a situation where both experts found, as in this case, the Menards case, all experts found that an executive would be more than pleased an independent investor would be more than pleased with his or her return. Now, with that said, I note that I have the white light, but for questions, I'll reserve the balance of the time for rebuttal. I do want to comment, though, please, on the disguised dividend, concealed dividend, bad faith test. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Hauser.
Good morning, Your Honor. Bethany Hauser for the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. What's really important about this case is the opportunity to grapple with the relationship between this Court's opinion in Exacto Spring and the Treasury regulation. As has already been pointed out, Exacto Spring creates a presumption. The government's conceded that presumption has arisen in this case, a presumption that the salary is reasonable. The question is what facts can the Court to look at to rebut that presumption? Mr. Dahlman has argued that the only facts that the Court can look at to rebut the presumption are the effort expended by the executive receiving the salary. The Exacto Spring does not expressly say that that's the only facts that can be looked at. And we have a regulation that says typically a reasonable salary is what like enterprises would pay for like services under like circumstances.
I don't see how that's an operational test. How can one gauge from the outside the performance of a chief executive officer? If the company is very profitable, that suggests he's at least doing a good job, but he may actually be responsible for the profitability. So, I just don't understand what the tax court can do.
To operationalize that phrase from the regulation now. What the tax court has done is found chief executives who are running similar businesses and look at what they are being.
Well, they're apparently not doing quite as well because Menards has a higher return on equity, and it's a highly competitive industry. It's a relatively new company. There's no particular reason to think it's not that its profitability is due to external factors.
Let me ask you the question in an operational way. New York Yankees have just agreed to pay $22.5 million a year to their first baseman.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And I want to know whether that is something that they can deduct as a reasonable salary. Now, it sounds like you would say you have to compare what the Yankees are paying their first baseman with the median salary of all the first basemen in baseball, maybe just Major League Baseball, and disallow anything over the median.
Well,
but that doesn't seem very sensible if the Yankees are paying for the best first baseman.
I certainly don't think it would necessarily be restricted to the median. In this case, the tax court permitted a salary that was higher than the salary for the executive of either Home Depot or Lowe's. So they weren't looking at the median.
As an operational matter, what do you do? Do you look at the median and then pick a number out of a hat?
You could look at what?
Some algorithm from which you can derive the reasonable salary by starting with the median. The median plus or minus two standard deviations, maybe?
I admit that there's no straightforward formula provided by the regulation.
Is there any non-straightforward formula? Is there any algorithm other than picking a number out of a hat, which doesn't sound very attractive?
Well, I don't think that picking a number out of a hat is what happened here or what has to happen.
Some algorithm. So you start with the median, and then what do you do to it?
You might want to adjust for the industry, and I'm not at all sure that you would look at the median. In the NFL, for example, a franchise player gets the average of the highest five salaries at that position, not the median salary at that position. So at the very least, you could start by looking at the highest salaries for other first basemen, and then you would look at whether this first baseman has special qualities that he brings to the circumstances.
But
The Yankees have been paying the highest wage in baseball to their third baseman for some time, but it's been a long time since they won the World Series. So why don't you say Boston and other teams have won the World Series, so the Yankees must be overpaying their third baseman and they can't deduct it?
Well, the owner might be interested in things other than winning the World Series in a particular year. There are ticket revenues to look at. I'm just saying these are all factors.
You see what the problem is. As soon as you say, look at everything in the world, I have no idea what weight these factors have, you don't have anything that's operational. Indeed, you have something that looks like the government is just arbitrarily telling people what they can pay their employees.
The government is not, there's no limit on what people can pay their employees here. The limit is on what they can deduct on their taxes. Mm-hmm. They can pay any amount, and the outcome of the case won't change that.
Well, we
have language in the statute that says they can may deduct a reasonable allowance for salaries.
Yeah, I understand that. And
it has to mean something.
Exacto has a test for reasonableness that depends on results. And I was wondering whether there was any other operational approach. And you haven't articulated one. I could add, there's one other question that intrigues me about looking at the relation between pay and results. Why just the salary of the CEO? Why doesn't one look at the salary of the whole management team?
I believe
suppose that John Menard is doing the work of four managers at Home Depot. Don't we need to compare his salary with the whole management team's salary?
I believe the tax court did, and the second highest paid person at Menards during the tax year in question made under $500,000 a year.
I didn't ask what the highest paying person made. I asked what is the pay of the entire management team. That is, you look at the people who are running the show and ask what they all made collectively.
Mm-hmm.
If John Menard is doing the work of four people at Home Depot, presumably he's entitled to the pay of four people at Home Depot, was there any effort to look at the total compensation of the executive teams?
Well, there are some executive salaries in the record, yes.
You're just not getting my question. No, I'm not asking salary of the CEO versus salary of the CEO. I'm asking about the total compensation of all members of the executive team. Add it up. Get a sum.
There's no comprehensive number for Menards in the record, no.
Okay.
Wouldn't it be a cleaner rule to say that the company can deduct whatever salary it decides to pay its CEO as long as its returns on investment are above average and related to the CEO's performance? Why shouldn't that be the rule?
The problem with that rule, which is a very clean rule, is that it doesn't seem in any way to operationalize the regulatory language, which looks to what similar corporations are paying for similar services under similar circumstances.
But I think what in fact the regulation aims at, what's extremely common in very small businesses is for the partners to pay out all the profits of the company in the form of salary.
Yes.
So that's the game that the regulation is aimed against. In a large company in such a competitive industry, it's not clear that that's applicable. Let me ask you about the structure of compensation of these competitive people. Now, Menard had a very low salary, so most of his salary was in the form of this 5%.
Yes.
Dependent on performance. So what about the other people, the CEOs of the competing companies? Do they have as much risk in their compensation package for their
I believe guys? The Home Depot CEO's compensation package did not include that much risk, and that it was a straight
but
cash,
now,
but
the
many
the,
of the others
the
did
the
include.
The CEO of Home Depot, that was Nardelli, right?
Excuse me?
Nardelli.
Yes, I believe it was. I'm not sure it's in the
now,
record.
Now, didn't Nardelli get a huge payment when he left Home Depot?
I don't believe it's in the record,
there was
but
a
yes,
lot
I believe
criticism
he did.
Of
yes.
That. And then he was hired, of course, by Ford.
Right.
Not doing so well. So, wouldn't we have to know a lot about his deal with Home Depot to know what kind of his compensation was just very backloaded, which is appropriate. But it can be, you got a very generous compensation, even though you don't get it really. You don't get most of it until you leave or some number of years passes. Is that in the record? What his contract was?
I believe both experts looked at the compensation as publicly available for what was publicly available information about what the executives had received, and really, what exactly that means is a factual question.
But what adjustment did they make for severance or pension or other backloaded compensation? Is that discussed?
The tax court adjusted the target compensation for
that was for stock options.
For stock options.
Yeah, but what about severance?
I don't believe that the that they were adjusted.
That's apparently what Nardelli got, right? When
yes.
he left,
yeah.
He got some tremendous severance. Now it could have been just a gift from the board, but it could have been contractual. Is that do we know that?
We don't know that. And it could have been contractual for reasons other than compensation for services rendered.
Why? Why, like what?
Well, you could have a severance that's based on keeping corporate secrets or, you know, other reasons that people would contract for a payment that would be other than payment for services rendered.
Yeah, that's possible. Well, but was that analyzed?
No.
So what is it that you would think is the... Is it just the raw difference between his $20 million and Nardelli's $3 million or whatever it was? Is that the basis of the tax court's decision, or is there more?
The court looked at other corporations rather than just Home Depot. It also looked at
right.
Lowe's and Target.
Okay. But is that all it is? Just a comparison of the different. Different people's pay? Is that the
yes, that appears to be
all?
The major part of that determination.
Would you be reassured if they had conducted some kind of, you know, if they'd hired one of these compensation consultants in 1978 and he had said, yeah, this, you know, Menard, he's the real spark plug of this company, and they try to hire someone who was as effective as he, they'd really have to pay a tremendous amount. Is there anything like that?
I would be more reassured if they'd hired that compensation consultant closer to the time at issue, but that would be reassuring. It would also be reassuring if there'd been any board independence in making this determination. If the board had been independent when it decided.
Yeah, but you can't have an meaningfully have an independent board when one person owns the whole company, right?
Well, that's why the regulation points out that this is precisely the circumstance where it's most likely that a dividend will be disguised as salary. I believe actually that the opinion in Exacto Spring makes exactly the same point. I'd just like to...
One of the things that particularly troubles me about the tax court's opinion is the notion you can derive some negative inference from the fact that from this reimbursement arrangement. I mean, given how the IRS and the tax court approaches these matters, there's enormous legal uncertainty. So why wouldn't it be perfectly appropriate to say, well, you know, if this thing unravels, we'll reimburse?
For one thing, I believe that negative inference is only relevant to the disguised dividend test as opposed to the reasonable amount test that we've been talking about. I think that the amount of uncertainty here is something that is not only in the government's favor. Certainly these are not easy cases for the government to bring.
I don't see the relevance of that. If you're in a situation where there's profound legal uncertainty, it's perfectly appropriate to take measures to insulate yourself from the consequences of having guessed wrong and gotten... I'm bothered by that. that they should think that's something to be criticized.
Well, I think the court is only using that to draw the inference that that the parties to that agreement see this as being an uncertain area.
Well, everyone knows it's uncertain.
Well, there are certainly salaries that would not. There are certain salaries that are safer than other salaries, would perhaps be one way of expressing it.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
The amount of uncertainty involved in paying a secretary, the going rate for secretaries in your market is going to be a very certain proposition, even though that salary payment is also deductible only to the extent it's reasonable or ordinary and necessary. So there's different degrees of uncertainty, even though there's uncertainty with respect to the deductibility of all salaries, really, under the statute. The amount of uncertainty will change depending on the facts and circumstances of the situation. I see that my time has expired, so I'd like to ask the court to affirm the tax court.
Anything further, Mr. Dolman?
I would like to come back, please, to a few questions that were addressed. One, I think it is entirely consistent with the modern contemporary corporate world that executives are compensated on a year-end bonus. That's point one. Point two is, to be clear, there is no evidence in the record as far as the type of services of any of the Lowe's executives or the Home Depot executives.
There's nothing on what, I'm sorry?
I beg your pardon?
There's nothing in the record about what?
There's no evidence in the record discussing, describing, illustrating the type of services performed by any of the executives in Home Depot or Lowe's. Now, my final point will be this, please. The issue of other shareholders approving of this bonus. I want to emphasize again the fact that when this bonus plan was created, Jeff Smith, a third-party shareholder, minority shareholder who was on the board, approved it. For that reason, we feel that both tests are satisfied. So subject to further questions, I'll close my remarks.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.
Thank you.